Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
There's a question that's been bugging me for a while now.
How many flies have ever existed?
Crowd Science, the podcast with a thirst for knowledge.
Why do we daydream?
Why is the sea salty?
We'll go and try and speak to some people and find out.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, the parallel market for trading in foreign exchange appears to be overtaking the official market in Nigeria. But is it legal?
That's a very tricky question. If they were really illegal, the government knows where to find them. They are not hidden because they are usually in street corners, usually near big monumental buildings or shopping malls or international airports. So they're in every corner.
And in the wake of the Olympic Games in Paris, we're wondering why so many African athletes choose to compete under foreign flags.
A lot of those countries, their management system is top-notch. Their welfare package is top-notch. Most times they have the best facilities you can ever imagine. And they have a very good rewarding system. And they have a lot of competitions to help the athlete perform to his best. And those are the reasons why a lot of athletes from African origin goes to different countries.
It's Monday, the 19th of August. First, we go to Cape Town. The Western Cape region of South Africa is one of the top 10 tourist destinations in the world. And the jewel in that crown is the city of Cape Town. It brings millions of dollars into the economy. So the city fathers of South Africa's mother city have always been, shall we say, protective of the way it looks. They've never taken kindly to homeless people on the streets, regarding them as an eyesore, spoiling the experience of visitors and residents alike. In the past, people were forcibly, violently removed from parts of the city the authorities wanted to appropriate. But a recent ruling in the Western Cape High Court displayed a different attitude. The court granted the city the right to evict homeless people from pavements across Cape Town. The city argued that the places those people lived in are unsafe and unfit for human habitation. But the court also ruled that the city should find different places for them to live and do the removals in a humane way. Our colleague Mo Ali is Cape Town born and bred. Who better to tell us more about the people affected by this ruling? Who are they? And how did they end up on the streets in the first place?
Yeah, it's a variety of people from various backgrounds, from people who've lost their jobs that have had hard times to people who have had fallouts with their respective families and decided to move onto the street thinking it would be a better life for them. There's also been cases of people who've just been born on the street and that's the only life that they know. And interestingly, there are also some refugees from foreign countries who have not been able to find accommodation. And so it's a variety of people from different backgrounds who occupy open spaces in the city centre, ranging from pavements to an open space next to the castle, which was built by the Dutch when they came in the 1600s. And, you know, just the complete different circumstances under which they live and different the kind of structures that they set up as well.
What's the main reason why the city wants to evict them from the city centre? Because we are talking about the city centre of one of the top 10 tourist destinations in the world. And maybe there's a clue in that.
Yeah, I think it definitely is an eyesore because we're looking at, you know, some of these structures which are range from basic plastic to cardboard and pieces of board that's been put up to even small little tents that people have been able to access. And, you know, it's right next to the tourist areas. But also, at the moment, we're still in a very harsh winter in Cape Town, which is very cold and wet. And it's not certainly not suitable conditions for people to live. There's no access to water or sanitation. And has the potential to breed disease and that kind of thing in these temporary shelters. And the city, to their credit, I must say, they haven't immediately evicted people. The court order was granted a few months ago, and there was consultation between representatives of the homeless people and the city council. And the city council has actually provided what they call safe spaces for 300 people in and around the city center to feed them 2 meals per day and to provide security. And also in terms of the court order, young children would have to be referred to the Department of Social Development for the psychological assessment, health assessments and all those kind of things. So it's not just a willy-nilly eviction of people having their belongings uprooted and just being thrown away. They have been offered the opportunity to move into safe spaces. Around 160 people have taken up the offers. Other people have moved back to their families, and other people just say they will resist and won't move.
I think we should point out that before now, in the democratic era in South Africa, you would see houses, people's shelters being broken down, there'd be a whole lot of violence around the issue. And city officials often accused of cruelty in the way that they would do it. It would often happen in winter. But this is not the case in this particular instance. And the city officials were citing safety concerns for both the people that are being evicted. There's definitely a change in attitude, right? But I'm wondering, are the numbers burgeoning? Are there bigger numbers of people on the streets?
Yeah, no, absolutely. In terms of the apartheid policy, people were moved from the areas around the city center and were moved to very far away from the city center, and it caused major social mayhem. And still, even though we're 30 years into the new democracy, we still have the spatial politics where people live in townships which are outside the city center, 10, 15 kilometers, 20 kilometers, even further. Khayelitsha is about 25 kilometers, Menenberg and those kind of areas. So we still have those spatial politics where people live in those respective group areas, and people of respective groups, as they were classified by the apartheid government, still very much live in those spaces. And it's difficult for people to move out of these areas because of the economic circumstances in which they find themselves.
So in terms of your family?
Yeah, my mom, her father actually had a farm, a grape farm and a flower farm in area of Constantia, which these days is one of the more expensive areas in Cape Town. And we successfully applied for land restitution. The process is still underway. We have been successful in getting the land back, although now it's just a question of getting the title deed and the subdivision sorted out. But as I mentioned, there are squatters living on the land now as well. And the Department of Land Restitution now has a problem having to find alternative accommodation for the people who are currently living in the informal settlement. It's probably about 10 informal structures on that land at the moment. So there is a bit of a problem in getting people off the land and providing alternative accommodation, because you cannot simply just willy-nilly move people off the land without giving them alternative accommodation.
It's a perennial problem in Cape Town. I bet you it goes back to the time when Cape Town became the first city in South Africa, established by Dutch traders and other European traders. This competition fight for rights and land, it can't go on like this. Are there any long-term solutions to it?
To their credit, once again, the city council has identified a number of pockets of land which they own. And remember, it's not only the city council, but it's also the national government that owns land. I just learned last week that there is so much land owned by the Defence Force in Cape Town, and it's large, large tracts of land that could be used for housing. So it's a matter of national government, provincial government and local government finding each other and making this land available. And, because as you mentioned, there's a massive housing backlog in Cape Town. I think we're talking about 600,000 units that need to be built. And to their credit, the city has started to identify land. They've started to build. And it's going to be a long-term process, let's face it. I mean, you've got an area called Blikkiesdorp, which is supposed to be a transitional area for people to move in corrugated iron structures in which they live. And it was supposed to be a temporary structure, but 20 years later, people are still staying there. And that shows the extent of the housing problem. And then you've also got an issue with construction mafia. Gangsters are trying to muscle in into the construction trade. That's another problem in Cape Town as well, where the city now has to contend with keeping out the construction mafia, as they're called, when looking at these long-term and big housing projects.
And there are also issues with people not wanting low-cost housing near their $10
million
dollar houses and so on, right?
Indeed. I mean, we've got a case close to where I live at the moment where there's a proposed housing project now that the city is looking to build 800 units. People are complaining. They're using the excuse of saying, it's going to impact on traffic. But I mean, it's an open piece of land, and the council is certainly within their right. And I think it's a good move by them as well to build this housing project on this huge piece of land. And you're going to have this problem all the time where, you know, people are going to resist thinking about and complaining about the prices of their houses being affected by having lower cost housing. And the same issue is in Muizenberg as well, you know, the tourist area that we mentioned earlier on, where the city wants to build a safe space. Once again, it's their land. So if they don't build on the land, people are going to complain. If they do build on the land, people are going to complain as well.
I suppose they need to find the political will to decide who they're going to listen to. Does that exist now? We have a government of national unity. The Democratic Alliance, which has run Cape Town for a long time, is now part of national government. Do you think we'll see movement on this?
You know, the city, to their credit, they have moved in terms of providing housing, but it's such a huge problem, and national government certainly needs to come to the party as well in terms of providing the land which they own and, you know, providing the funding as well. But in the end as well, it's going to come down to doing something about the unemployment rate, you know, finding jobs for people so that they can have an income, so that they can pay for the housing as well.
Muhammad Ali in Cape Town. If you look at what is trending in Nigeria on any given day, you'll see lots of things. But what you will see a lot of as well are searches using the words hashtag USD to Naira or hashtag black market dollar to Naira and other variables of those words. This trend has become particularly prominent as the value of the Nigerian Naira depreciated in the regular and parallel currency or black market. So what is the black market Naira? It's an intriguing story, which begins with a boom in the foreign exchange market in the 1970s, when Nigeria was booming. But a crisis in the foreign exchange market in 1982 made foreign money more difficult to obtain, even though the demand remained high. And that's where a parallel market began in earnest. My colleague Nkechi Ogbonna is in Lagos, and she'll pick up the story. But let's hear first why so many Nigerians keep a sharp eye out on the daily gyrations of the Naira.
I've never been a fan of black market. When I wanted to pay school fees for my younger child at UK, because of the old urgency and we're working with timelines, the bank where you logged your Form A, they work with queues. We had to resort to black market, and the difference was huge.
I'd rather exchange dollar via the black market than through banks, because I think they give a higher rate.
Now, back to our senior West Africa business reporter, Nkechi Ogbonna in Lagos. Let's talk about the black market, how it operates, and I suppose the clue is in the name. Mm-hmm. It's a parallel market to the Bureau de Change or the BDCs, is it?
Exactly. So black market operators are people who make a living through money exchange outside the purview of the central bank. So they most times they get foreign exchange from different sources, and then they are in every street corner in many major cities across Nigeria, to be specific. So what they do is they help people who want very quick access to foreign exchange to change it. These people are usually not documented, so they do not have licenses to operate, and they do not also require the necessary documentation that a regular BDC or a commercial bank will require from you in order for you to access foreign exchange. They are like the underground economy. They benefit from the markup between the official rate and the unofficial rate. That's how they make their money.
So are they illegal, or are they just, you know, slightly shady?
That's a very tricky question. If they were really illegal, the government knows where to find them. They are not hidden because they are usually in street corners, usually, you know, on the streets, sometimes near big monumental buildings or shopping malls or international airports. So they are in every corner. So the government knows where to find them if indeed they are deemed illegal. But because of the documentation process and sometimes the lengthy wait period that it takes for people to access foreign exchange formally or legally from commercial banks, these black market operators now step in to bridge that gap of the wait time, of the documentation process, etc. And so if you ask me again, Audrey, are they illegal? The answer is I do not know.
So how do they determine their exchange rate? Because it's usually different to the official exchange rate. And in fact, it's usually more favorable to somebody buying.
So it differs for Nigeria ever since, and even before the multiple exchange rate era was scrapped by the central bank, black market operators usually are quicker to get rates from. Now, whether it's cheaper or more expensive is a question of demand and supply. What they do is, and how they operate is, they speculate. So they may perceive that there is a surge in demand for foreign exchange. Let's say it's the start of an academic year and they know that lots of Nigerians would want to pay tuition fees abroad, or they know it's summer and Nigerians would want to travel abroad for vacation, etc. So they speculate, and based on the huge demand for foreign currencies, they jack up the rates. And it's difficult for the official figures to catch up with unofficial rates. And that lag in between is now where those black market operators benefit. So because they speculate the currency, because they assume or sometimes create even artificial scarcity by hoarding the foreign exchange. So those who genuinely need it for whatever reasons, legitimate reasons that they have, will not have access to foreign exchange. And so they create artificial scarcity sometimes, and that causes a huge disparity between the official rates and the unofficial rates. And most times it's because the official rates, it's very difficult to get foreign exchange from the official rates. That's through the central bank or through commercial banks. So a lot of people just quickly run to the black market to get it because it's quicker, it's more convenient, and is less documentation that is required.
How does the dealings of the black markets and these unofficial operators affect the financial sector in Nigeria?
Now, because of this currency speculation, so that's the first one. Sometimes when there's scarcity, people panic, and importers, you know, who need foreign exchange to pay their overseas suppliers or to bring in their raw materials or whatever, are stranded. And so it affects the free flow of the dollar into the Nigerian economy. Now, because Nigeria has a huge import bill, what that means, Audrey, is Nigeria imports way more than it exports. And so there is huge reliance on foreign exchange, because that's what you need to pay your suppliers, Audrey, assuming you're an importer. So because there is that huge demand, a lot of people want to pay foreign exchange overseas. It's not available. So what people now do is they rush to the black market to get that. That's number one. And then secondly, Nigeria had a list of items that were prohibited from accessing foreign exchange. Now, the government at the time argued that if it curbed access to the people in these sectors that require foreign exchange, it would help local manufacturers, you know, and boost local production, the local economy, etc. But over time, we've seen that that encouraged smuggling, for instance. So those people would go through neighboring countries to still bring in their goods. And it also encouraged the black market, because what that means is, if I'm an importer of rice, for instance, and the government says I cannot have access to foreign exchange if I want to import rice because Nigerians should buy rice from local farmers, what that means is I'll still go to the black market to source my foreign exchange to pay my foreign partner to bring in the rice illegally into the country. So what that means is there is a huge demand for the foreign exchange, and there is not enough available locally for me to do my business.
We speculated earlier about whether it's legal or shady or dodgy or illegal. I would put my head on a block and say it's illegal, simply because at the level of where it happens. But I'm just wondering, who are the people who are involved in the black markets? How do they get the foreign exchange that they're dealing with?
So the BDC operators are the ones who are licensed by the central bank to go to commercial banks and get foreign exchange legally. However, these black market operators sometimes get their money through money laundering. I mean, the federal government in February this year, you know, cracked down on a lot of them in the capital city, Abuja, where it went to close down a lot of these black market operators. And even the government sees over 4,000 licenses of BDC operators, because it said they did not meet the regulatory guidelines for accessing Forex and also selling foreign exchange in the market.
So that's 4,000 supposedly legal bureaus. These are not the black market operators. Okay. So the extent of the problem, I can see it's huge.
Exactly. So the extent of the problem is quite huge. And then some economists also allege that some of these licensed operators were engaging in illegal currency speculation, in illegal trading, and all of that. And they were also encouraging money laundering. When that foreign exchange gotten from these illegal means lands in the hands of some black market operators, it's gotten at a cheaper rate. So because it's not gotten from the official rate. So that, again, now helps them to speculate the currency and fix rates at will, which now affects the official rate and the legal means in which people can access foreign exchange. It's a bit very technical and very complex, Audrey, I must confess. But indeed, these are the reality of many Nigerians.
Have politicians brought in measures or even attempted to bring measures into effect to tackle the issue of the black market exchange?
Well, apart from the central bank, who is the regulator that seized over 4,000 licenses earlier in the year, politicians have not really done anything, I know, policy-wise to scrap the black market in the country.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Audrey. Lovely speaking to you.
Always. Nice talking to you as well. That's Nkechi Ogbonna, our senior West Africa business reporter in Lagos. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't know if you've noticed, but in major sporting competitions, you often see African athletes competing under a flag that's not their own. And I'm not talking about people born and bred in other countries because their parents migrated there in the past. I'm talking about people who were born and raised in one country, who then compete under the flag of a completely different country. At the just-concluded Olympics in Paris, Kenyan-born Winfred Yavi, for instance, won a gold medal for Bahrain. She's just one of a growing number of athletes who leave their home countries in search of greener pastures, or greener pitches in this case. But Africa's young, dynamic population presents a massive opportunity for talent in every field of human endeavor to thrive. So why are we not taking advantage of it in the sporting arena? I had a conversation about this with Kenyan distance runner Douglas Wakihuri and Nigerian sprinter Deji Aliu, two athletes who became coaches and who both spent time training abroad but kept on competing for their home countries. Douglas started by telling us some of the reasons why an athlete might choose to switch allegiance to another country.
I think one of the reasons is because denied opportunity and feeling that I am good, I am talented, and I will not get an opportunity. That is one driver that drives you out. Number two, against your will, probably at 16 years old, you're sold out there to go out to another country, which you probably have no way to decide yes or no without your consent or with your parents deciding or looking at the monetary value that you're going to get after you leave the country. But I think one of the biggest or major reasons is that denied opportunity to most of the athletes or denied recognition. For example, most of us will go because they feel that they're not recognized in this country.
Deji, we've just heard described there what Douglas was talking about were push factors, the reasons why people would go. What about pull factors? Are there countries that actually make themselves attractive to athletes, knowing that they can entice them to come and run or to perform their sporting code? What would those be? What would make an athlete, do you think, give up their flag to go somewhere else? What does that other country have to do to entice them there?
A lot, you know, what those countries need to do is just like what they are not getting from their own country, and they are enormous. For example, you know, a lot of those countries, their management system is top-notch. Their welfare package is top-notch. Most times they have the best facilities you can ever imagine, and they have a very good rewarding system, and they have a lot of competitions to help the athletes perform to his best. And those are the reasons why a lot of athletes from African origin goes to different countries. I talk about Nigeria, for example. We have lack of facilities.
you know, the rewarding system is nothing to write them about. You know, a lot of athletes would rather go represent other countries where the reward will be something they can celebrate forever.
I'm wondering, Deji, because sporting achievement and sport itself is waged on such a national pride kind of basis, the flag and the people that you come from, you know, you represent their pride. How difficult is it for an athlete to decide, well, actually, I'm going to go away from my country, away from my people, my flag, because I'm going to get a better reward elsewhere? Is it just about the reward?
Well, basically, it's not really about the reward, but the reward is part of it. Okay, for example, as an athlete, you go through a lot to train to be the best in the world, and along the line, maybe you get injured, and the country is not there for you. You are alone. You know, the burden of the medical, how to get back, is all on you. Those are a few things that make an athlete decide, okay, if my country cannot be there for me when I need them, then why am I there for my country?
Douglas presented with that choice. What would you have done when you were still active?
I think from my part of life that I spent in Japan, for me, I was more patriotic and I kept my allegiance to this country that I love deeply in my heart and dearly. And also, I think one of the reasons that why we should stay around is for the new generation coming up not to move away from this country. This country needs legends and all these people to be around.
Let's talk about that in just a moment. I just want to ask Deji the same question first. Deji, if you were given the option, what would you have done? Were you ever offered that option?
I had those options. I stayed in Italy for over a decade, so it would have been easier for me to switch my allegiance, but I decided not to because, I mean, I don't have reason to. You know, I love my country and I was ready to give my country my all. So, yeah, I had the opportunity, but I just decided not to.
Let's pick up, Douglas, where you were going to go with young people and why we need to retain talent. And I also want to ask you, as part of that, if a young athlete came to you and said, listen, I'm thinking about going to go and run for Bahrain or for Saudi Arabia because they're offering me big bucks, what advice do you give them?
Number one, you know, when you are at 16 years of age, the country does not offer you any package. That is simply an opportunity for you to go to train out there. That is the way it comes in. Now, I have many, many athletes who have come to me. And one of the things that I tell them, if I didn't come back here, you will not have an opportunity to talk to me. And because I love this country. So number one, you need to keep your allegiance to this country because when you fly your country's flag, there is a lot of trust, a lot of inspiration, a lot of courage and determination that is given to the Kenyan people who are looking up at you on the stage or on the podium winning the medal. And you've done everything right from a dreaming to the action. The joy of winning a gold medal does not belong to the holder. It belongs to the people of that particular country. So my advice would be, if it's within your understanding, just give it time, and sooner or later, you will become a champion. Because to be a champion, it's not about money. Because if then, many people would have bought it with money, but it doesn't. It is a time consuming, so you have to invest your time. You have to believe and dream.
Deji, what about you? What advice do you give your young charges?
Oh, well, I'll tell them to think about it, you know, to look at it critically before making such a decision. Because, you know, most times they don't turn out good, some don't. So I'll tell them to, you know, have a critical look at it before they decide what they want to do.
Now, you know, the continent has the youngest population in the world, and there are prodigiously talented people who come through even though there's an underinvestment in sport, there's an underinvestment in education. Africans still shine on the international stage. I'm just wondering whether it's just one of those things that we can afford to give to the world. Or am I wrong in thinking that this trend has a negative impact on African sport if countries continue to lose their top athletes to other countries?
It's definitely going to have a negative effect on us because now it's going to show the world that we're not good in managing our resources, our athletes. I mean, basically, that's what it means. Because if an athlete leaves a particular country and they switch allegiance to another country and becomes a world champion, Basically, what that means is, you know, we lack management drive, and that's a negative vibes to the country.
Douglas, do you think that we've got talent to burn, or do you think it reflects negatively on us if people leave and become champions elsewhere?
If I give you an example of the just rescinded in Paris, I think we saw the steeplechase was Bahrain, Kenyan. It is impacting on us negatively for decisions that we wrongly made. I believe that because I do not see any official who can see a talent that does not want that talent to remain at home. And so the other thing probably would be, why is it African federations are unable to bring the events that we go to Europe to be in Africa? And I believe it is high time all the African heads come together and decide that we can bring this event instead of selling our athletes out there, because even the money that is coming in probably is just not that much compared to what Africa can generate as a whole with the population that we have in sports alone.
So what do you think African countries should do better to retain top talent and also to develop points that you're making now about, you know, making sure that we can attract international events as well?
Number one, what we have failed is on facilities. We have failed to manage all the necessities that give our young athletes potential space to train. If you look at within Africa, the standard of facilities is not class one or class two, and they are not certified. So we need to improve on that. Number two, we need to have a leadership in place that those who are managing sports federations are people who have ethics, they have passion in sports, rather than being politically driven, elected for sports events or sports governing. And we also have to have the pride and the passion of seeing Africa grow in the way we are pushing our athletes to go out there and make the other continents shine. We need to have the power of Africa as a continent by itself.
Okay, to you both, thank you so much. It's been really interesting talking to you.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I was in conversation there with Douglas Wakihuri from Kenya and Deji Aliyu from Nigeria. Focus on Africa was put together by Blessing Aderogba in Lagos. Bella Hassan and Rob Wilson pitched in from London. Paul Bachibinga was our senior producer. Nick Randall, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.